This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
This week on a special Valentine's Day edition of Meet and Three, we put a twist on the lovey-dovey holiday.
The mission statement is save the world through silliness and chocolate, and in parentheses, launch a chocolate bar into outer space. But I'm having some conflict on the board members with the parentheses. That's okay.
He cited that in his area there used to be 30 dairy farms and now there are 3.
You know, dessert was political, and what you had on the dessert table said more about you than other markers of success.
Tune in to Meet and Three, HRN's weekly food news and storytelling roundup wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Allie Kane. Welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building and growing consumer brands. When we launched a line of fresh sauces, I knew we were jumping into something crazy. Haven's Kitchen is a cooking school, cafe, and event space. A product that people buy in grocery stores is an entirely new business, and I had a lot to learn. So in my efforts to get myself educated, I started meeting everyone I know and respect who could advise me on production and distribution, sales and legal, PR, and social media. Then I started having those conversations here as a podcast so that other entrepreneurs can learn from them as well. This is the story of Haven's Kitchen Sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Maya Kaimal, the original refrigerated sauce queen. Maya launched her line of fresh Indian simmer sauces in 2003, and since then has built a brand synonymous with quality and nutritious, accessible Indian food. Maya's sauces, chips, and ready-to-eat dal and rice are available in 7,000 stores, including Whole Foods, Sprouts, Safeway, Albertsons, Costco, Target, Walmart, and many, many more. Maya's products are consistently praised by media critics and consumers, and I'm so happy to have her here today to share some of the wisdom she's gained in 16 years in the business. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this is a big day for me. I feel like I'm really excited. I really am. You were one of the first people that I sort of looked to for why isn't anyone else doing fresh sauce? You were doing it very, very early on. I feel like you've maybe also brought in some other things that might be better for your margins. So I want to ask you about that as we move on. But I just feel like I'm sort of speaking to someone who can be very helpful for me. So I'm grateful that you're here.
Well, thank you. No, it's great to be here. It's been an interesting journey.
Yeah. So before we get into the actual sort of product journey, I know you grew up here, but you traveled a lot to India.
Yes.
Is that right? So where did you grow up and what did you want to be?
Well, I grew up in Boston and then my family moved to Boulder, Colorado when I was 10. So we did travel back to India quite a bit and we would be visiting family in the southern part of India, but we did sightseeing all over, so I really got to see what a lot of India was like.
Was it Kerala?
Kerala, exactly, yes.
I did a paper on Kerala for my master's program, because it kind of seems like a utopian place.
It's quite different from the other parts of India. It has a very interesting history with all the spice trade that really focused on that specific part of India, so that kept it exposed to all these other, cultures, the Portuguese, the Dutch, the English were there, and the Arabs way before that, the Phoenicians, the Chinese, trade winds, exactly.
Well, it's interesting because the way, and this is a little just food trivia, there's a huge difference between Northern Indian cuisine and Southern Indian cuisine because there's this mountain range kind of in the middle, and so if you picture it, just all of the winds that are going
to the bottom of the continent was, you know, all of those ships carrying all of those different people with all of those different spices and ingredients. It's, you know,
that
kind of amazing.
Monsoons helped kind of like, you know,
bring the boats in.
Yeah, exactly.
So was when you were in Boston and then in Boulder, did your family eat traditional Southern Indian food, or were you kind of, was it special occasions, or how is your relationship with Indian food?
So my father's Indian, my mother's American, and my mother was really inspired by Julia Child while I was growing up. So that was a very strong kind of influence, I guess, on what we were eating, because my mother just cooked out of Julia Child's cookbook, like most nights. So my father would try to recreate this Indian food of our travels or of a relative or a friend, something he tasted that he thought like was particularly delicious. So he would do that on the weekends. And then so our family would often eat Indian food on the weekends and for special occasions. My dad.
And your dad would cook it.
He would cook it. And my mom really would help too. But he, yeah, he kind of had a pretty clear idea what he wanted to do.
And your relationship with it, sometimes when there's, you know, when you're a young kid in Boston or Colorado and there's these like spices that are flowing through your house, there are friends of mine who've had experiences with that where they're like, oh, dad's making that stuff again. Like, I hope, you know.
It was never like that. It was, in fact, some my friends would smell the food and be like, can we stay for dinner? Yeah. What is your dad making?
That's so cool. That's so, so nice.
It was positive. And I think, you know, India was just a very positive place for me. It wasn't something that I was ever embarrassed about. Or, you know, my mother completely embraced my father's Indian heritage, like dove right in. She had long lists of sightseeing places she wanted to go and things she wanted to do there. So
very positive.
Our trips there were lovely. I mean, I was falling in love with the textiles as much as the food.
Amazing.
And like, it was all just kind of a
Have siblings?
Yeah, I did. I have an older brother and older sister.
And were you the young kind of scrappy left on her own one, or were you quiet, or were you like, what was your
I was the youngest, and I was quieter. I was kind of letting my
make the mistakes
letting them sort of figure stuff out and just observing.
That my youngest definitely learns from everything that I don't like that the older four do, and then is basically a prince. So he gets all of the, and everyone's like, ugh, really? Because I think he's kind of perfect. He has the benefit of learning from his elder siblings' mistakes. So do you remember what you wanted to be when you grew up?
Yeah, I wanted to be an artist or a graphic designer.
Artsy.
Yes.
Creative.
And then it sort of ended up, photography was what I focused on in college. And so that's kind of where my career started.
Right. And so you were a photo editor at Savoir. Mm-hmm. And did you go straight to the magazine after college, or did you make a
few
stops? I
went into the magazine industry right out of college. Right. Yep. I started as an assistant in the art department.
Very cool.
Of magazine, and then moved to worked at, you know, some Hearst magazines, Time Inc. I was
always
sort of
food?
Moving through. No, women's magazines. Right. One was Us Magazine, Entertainment. So, no, it was only when I got to Savoir that I really got to bring together my two biggest passions.
Amazing. And how do you remember sort of what did that inspire in you? Or do you remember sort of like what you took out of that experience marrying those two things that you loved so much?
Well, I mean, I was utterly devastated when I got laid off. I'll tell you that because it was like, wait a minute, this is the perfect job for me. this is like, I can't do any better. But so, I mean, it was, what was extra fun and lucky for me was I had actually written a feature like a few years before I started working there, but because of all the lag time,
right.
It ended up running while I was there. So I got actually photo edit my own story.
Oh, that's amazing.
And really see it go into layout. And
that never happens.
Never.
That's so cool.
So that
And did you write the cookbooks when you were photo editing?
Yeah, I did write them while I was a photo editor. Okay. Right. My second one came out when I was at Savour, right. And my first one came out a few years before.
So you had a very successful career. I mean, the fact that you were able to publish two cookbooks and be a photographer at, you know, a pretty important food magazine. And this is a while ago, but I mean, even then that was a big deal.
Well, I mean, it was a lot, you know, having this sort of side hustle thing with the man with the cookbooks going on.
Right.
It was kind of like, oh, but it was, but I could, the interest in food was definitely very powerful for me.
Right.
So I felt like I needed that part of my life. So even if I wasn't writing cookbooks, I was
engaged
thinking about
food.
What kind of articles I could write. And the nice thing at Savour was I got to write some pieces, other pieces for the magazine,
which
too.
Is amazing. And then it all kind of came crashing down one day, which is, you know, the story of, I feel, so many founders.
Yeah.
Very few people take the leap without getting shoved off the cliff, in my opinion.
I think you're absolutely right, because it's too hard to contemplate.
Right,
or, you know,
and you're losing too much.
Yes,
but
exactly.
You know, what? So you got laid off from the Savour job, and then what happened in your brain that was like, I mean, had you thought about making, because you started with the simmer sauces. That was the first product, right? And had you thought about, like, why doesn't this exist? Or,
well, it did strike me that what was available in stores was just didn't resemble how I thought of Indian food at all.
Right.
And the kinds of ingredients that were being put in there, it's like, you know, what is this?
Yeah.
This isn't food as we eat it at home.
Right.
So that bothered me. But it was really this while I still had my job at Savour, my friend Andy Ahrens, he was, I'd met my husband, he was friends with my husband, we would have dinner parties, he would give me some feedback on what I was making. And
Andy was at that time the owner of Gourmet Garage?
The owner of Gourmet Garage, yes. So he had that chain of stores, and he started saying, why don't you make some sauce? Like, I would totally carry it in my stores. I don't have much to choose from.
Right.
And you could do something really exciting. And and why don't you do that? Why don't you do it? And I was like, no, I can't. That whole thing,
right?
Just like, I'm busy. Yeah. I've got a job.
Right.
But then when I didn't have the job, then it just looked like the obvious thing to do. Like, okay.
And how did you make the first, I mean, was there HPP then?
So,
like, how did you even cold process anything?
No, we were not. We were hot filling. So
I see.
Yeah. And the whole thing about doing it refrigerated was just out of one of the many conversations that I had as I was trying to explore this. And Andy was introducing me to people, and I was getting to know some of the Specialty Food Association people.
So they were cooked sauces.
Yeah.
But you merchandise them in refrigerated.
Correct.
Which is
amazing. The thing about it, because one of the people was like, you should do them fresh, like fresh pasta sauce, make fresh India. Nobody's doing that.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, that's a great idea, because I feel like it'll taste more like a homemade sauce. So the nice thing about being refrigerated was that, well, yes, it's fully cooked. You don't have to have quite the same pH level, right? So you have some flexibility there, and that can really be a
huge
very,
game changer.
Make a big difference in flavor.
Yeah. People who are listening who aren't in the refrigerated world, think about it this way. I think you have to have a sort of a shelf stabilized product is about a 3.8 or something.
Yeah, 3.9.
Yeah.
Maybe you can get to 4.
Right.
Maybe.
And ours is like 4.5, 4.4.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be 4.6 if it's refrigerated. So if you think about just the amount of acid that you have to add to something to lower the pH to make it, you know, shelf stable, it's going to end up tasting different than it would at a higher pH.
Exactly.
So, right. Okay. So you made for Gourmet Garage. You made how many flavors?
We had three flavors when we launched, tikka masala, coconut curry, vindaloo. My husband and I had a big argument over whether we were going to do tikka masala or not because I was really dead set against it. I'm like, it's so obvious.
Yeah, but
he's like, come on. People need that's obvious. That's going to be the best seller.
I know. You're speaking to someone who made Romesco, and everyone's like, I'm sorry? What? What's Romanesco? What? You know, so
yeah.
Something that people can latch on to is probably, your husband was probably right.
Yeah, he definitely was right. It was our best seller. But so those were the three flavors, and what I was doing by choosing those flavors was also bringing in some of the South Indian flavors, right? So the coconut curry totally resembled the South Indian flavor profile where it's coconut based, it's got mustard seeds and curry leaves, green chili, you know. Yeah, so that was really at the the idea was I want more people to taste this kind of food.
And how did you make it for Gourmet Garage? Like that first, you know, when you were first making it, like how did
you
do that?
So I found a manufacturer in upstate New York who had a small business. He basically had like a single kettle and he was making fresh pesto for some of the New York City, you know, gourmet shops. And he was willing to take a chance on this kind of unknown Indian product.
So and, cool. Yeah. And what was your shelf life at that point?
So actually pretty good. We were able to get, right off the bat, we got 90 days.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing.
And then we were eventually able to get to 120 days.
Great. So,
but yeah, it was not, it didn't have to move quickly. The stores had some time.
Right. You know? No, it's great. And did you have a plan at that point? I mean, I guess there were like six Gourmet Garages or something.
Like that, yeah.
Did you, were you like, let's see how we do here and then maybe I'll go start talking to other stores? Or what was the plan?
I actually had three first customers. So the Gourmet Garage was one. Calusnians was one, right? Because I was very friendly with the owners. And so they were willing to take it on too. Yeah. And then Fairway, I was actually able to sell it into as well. So the that was kind of a chance to figure out how we were, you know, how we were doing.
How it was going to work.
And they all did really well with it kind of right off the bat, which was like very surprising to all of us. But it was just,
It was really, I mean, it's really good. So the question I always ask around now is like, when do you remember a moment where you knew you had a business? Like, do you remember a moment where like, okay, I'm going to do this, or now we're going to invest some real time and energy, or now this is my job.
Mm. Well, so, I mean, I just remember one moment of that sense that like, oh my God, I think this could actually work, was when Fairway was calling me, like, the stuff is flying.
Yeah, amazing.
We can't keep it on the shelf.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, that's happening at Fairway?
Yeah.
Wow. So it just, it made me feel confident about walking into the other retailers in New York City and just saying, hey, you know, we're moving this much product in a week at Fairway. You really should have us. And then getting a New York Times review and Florence Fabricant's column just kind of sealed the deal because that I had the great thrill of seeing people walking around with that clipping in the store and looking for
it. No, it's great. So. Amazing. Okay, we're going to take a little break. And then when we come back, you're going to just basically walk us through the next 16 years in a half an hour. Okay. It should be easy. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick. with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
I'm back with Maya Kamal, the founder and chief everything of the eponymous company. Okay, so 2003, you got on the shelves.
Yep.
By 2004-ish, you knew you had a thing.
Yep.
And then what happened then? I mean, basically, by the time it was... By a few years later, you were in like 3,000 doors, I think, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, that it certainly took some time getting there. But what happened around 2005, 2006 was we started getting approached by Williams-Sonoma and Costco.
Yep.
And they wanted us to make things for them. And
right.
That just shifted the whole business. I mean, particularly Costco.
Right.
Williams-Sonoma was great as a, you know, a marketing
right.
tool, really.
But
you know,
Costco's got the volume.
And Costco had the volume.
Yeah.
So we were able to kind of further, you know, with the Williams-Sonoma, we were further establishing ourselves as like a really
right.
like sort of high quality
yes,
producer. And
for
that
sure.
was another part of the thinking behind going out with fresh. I think we always knew that we would ultimately be doing shelf-stable products
right.
because that's how you scale your business.
Yep.
But being in the marketplace with fresh, we would be so different from everything else that was
yep.
out there, right?
Yeah.
Different part of the store.
Where were you merchandised?
So that was always a,
yeah.
a question. But usually with in the specialty section of the store, so with cheeses and
right.
pestos and
right.
tapenades.
Which usually, I mean, I feel like they're usually made, you know, they're usually kind of private label.
Right.
You know, so you were sort
brand.
Of like one of the only brands
mm-hmm.
in the sea of, I'm trying
right.
to remember when I first, I think I probably first got excited about them at Whole Foods,
mm-hmm.
I think. And I'm trying to remember where I would pick
they
them
would have
up.
Been in the cheese
yeah.
set. That's
yeah.
where we, in fact, my husband made that sale. He just walked into the Chelsea Whole Foods because
wow.
that was the only one back then
yeah.
in New York.
Yeah.
And just said, my wife's too shy, but we've got this sauce. So what?
Oh, that's so nice.
And they're like, oh, yeah, we're interested
right.
in that.
And so going back to Costco for a second, because
yeah.
there's a lot of people with a lot of advice about Costco. And I mean, there are a lot of companies that build their entire businesses on Costco.
Mm.
They do want you to build them different things,
mm.
right? Like
yeah.
they want different, do they want different SKUs or do they
well,
just want it packaged
yeah.
differently? Or
it can be both. It really just
right.
depends. You know, in our case, we've taken the retail, those three original flavors
mm-hmm.
and put them into a three pack.
Right.
And they were happy with, you know, with that, and that sold really well. But often they want you to take that and double the size or,
right.
you know, make it somehow bigger and bespoke for them.
And is there any lesson that you've learned working with Costco
mm-hmm.
that, you know, would be helpful
oh.
for founders?
Well, you know, it's fantastic business to have. Obviously, that goes without saying. But you can never kind of get, like, over your skis. You can't
yeah.
you can't take it for granted.
Right.
You have to be ready to pivot, you know, and have a solid business, even if that volume goes away.
Right. Yeah.
It's that highly
Which is hard because
thing.
People... you know, you end up building an entire sort of supply chain to support that. And
right.
if it goes away quickly, you're left with,
right.
you know, people
yeah.
and product.
But the good thing about Costco is that they're very honorable in terms of if
They'll
they
give
make
you time.
A, yeah, and if they make a commitment to
mm-hmm.
you, they will fulfill that commitment.
Right.
So you don't have, you're not like stuck with a ton of stuff, or hopefully you're not.
Right.
Yeah. But they, I think the thing that it is that's challenging as a business owner is that you really can't project
yeah.
into the next year with any certainty
yeah.
at all.
I know.
So you want to make sure that your retail business is a good chunky size of
right.
Because that part you can predict.
So when you were, I mean, first of all, it's so interesting, right? Because there was no online, there was no Amazon. The only two channels really for, well, I guess there were sort of three. Because you had club, you had sort of your grocery. I guess natural was sort of different than conventional at that time. Yeah, and then you had specialty.
Right. Yeah.
So did you break it down that way a little bit? Or?
We really started in specialty, right?
Right.
So that was, so we were sort of thinking of ourselves as like specialty slash natural and club. So it felt like two channels to us because the conventional has been like a later, you know, development for our business. So, but specialty, I mean, it was a much easier kind of sell in, right? So, I mean, things were probably even easier back then, maybe. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, that department can always make a little more room for your product, right? It's not as planogrammed in and rigid, and it didn't have the same like review schedules and things that like you had to, you know, adhere to before you even had a shot at getting in. So, so that, but that's. That channel, we really quickly were able to move into natural too, because those two, there is, you know, kind of a, I don't know, I think those two relate well to each other, same kind of consumer.
Yeah. I mean, I think the lines are getting a little blurred now. I remember people, like, even when I first started, you know, thinking about this, they were like, there's natural, there's conventional, there's progressive conventional, there's progressive natural, you know, it's like, okay, like, what, you know? So, but do you remember, like, do you remember the first West Coast sale you had? Or, like, do you remember, you know, sort of, like, do you remember how you were thinking about it back then? Or were you just kind of like, wow, there's another account that wants us, we'll make it and we'll see how it goes?
In our situation, we had this distributor who had a Northeast presence and a Northern California presence. They were called the Cheeseworks. They're not around anymore.
Right.
But they had salespeople who were extremely well educated on all their products and passionate foodies. So they weren't just like filling orders, they were like, they were out there selling.
So that's amazing.
They had, and they had Whole Foods too. So in that case, we were like, we just want to go wherever you guys go. So help build our business out. So because they also had Whole Foods, it was like getting into all these nice cheese shops and then getting into Whole Foods in on the East Coast and the West Coast, and then started filling in in the middle. So, you know, but those coasts obviously are the places that are receptive to this kind of new, you know.
And did you think about it like, okay, we're building brand in these accounts and we're like getting volume from Costco?
Yes. Right. We were using the volume.
It's a good way to think about it.
The Costco enabled us to really build out our infrastructure or, you know, just our staffing. You know, we brought on our first CEO, and we could only afford them because we had the Costco volume.
Right.
So yeah.
What made you decide to bring on a CEO?
Because I think I know pretty well where my strengths lie.
Right.
And I thought if the business is going to rely on me like 100% for growth, it's probably not the best thing for the business.
Right.
It would be better served by someone who really kind of understood the marketing and ops pieces and, you know, there's a lot.
And you were able to afford that from the sales from the product or did you have to go raise money
to do
that?
No, we didn't have to raise any money. I mean, this was also a nice thing about, you know, being a fresh product and sort of just-in-time manufacturing.
Yeah.
So, you know, you weren't carrying inventory.
Yeah.
We didn't have to have a lot of overhead or anything.
Cool.
So, yeah, so in that way, we kept our costs pretty low, and we were making money. And
it's amazing.
It was like, wow, this is kind of working.
Do you feel like you had any, like, were there a few sort of like, oh, wow, this is not working moments, like, in between then?
I mean, we've had
ups and downs.
We've definitely had ups and downs. We've had product launches that failed. We tried launching these fresh chutneys and they were kind of like dips and they were delicious, but they had a short shelf life.
Right.
So we decided at one point to shrink our fresh retail sauces.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that because Obviously, yes. that's a big question for me.
That was a lesson learned. Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, tell me about it.
So we have, you know, still selling the fresh sauces. This is now like 13 years into the business.
Right.
They had, you know, a really amazing run.
Yeah.
You know, and then they were.
How many SKUs were there in fresh at that time?
At least six.
Okay.
We did six. But we had brought in, this is now a different CEO, because
right.
our first one had moved back to West Coast and wanted to move on to other things. So we brought in someone else, and there was a decision made to shrink the size a little bit, right,
uh-huh.
to go from a 15 and a half ounce to an 11 and a half ounce,
right?
So sort of significant, but trying to hit a lower price point and thinking that maybe we would be able to take it into more conventional markets
right.
with a lower price point, well, like $4.99 instead of a $5.99, $6.99.
Which is still, by the way, I mean, today, that I don't think people would blink at 15 ounces for,
mm-hmm.
you know, $6.99. I mean, it's, you know,
yeah,
but.
Clearly,
right.
it was for lots of reasons. we didn't think about it the right way because
right.
we ended up, it prompted a UPC change.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just, you know, for all you nice people out there,
yeah.
don't do it.
So let's talk a little bit about this because I don't actually think that this has come up in the 66 episodes that I've done.
New.
But we actually had a UPC change very early on. Our nutty lemongrass was originally peanut lemongrass.
Oh.
And I just was too nervous.
I know
cashew's also an allergen, but they're just, the peanut stuff is scary. So before it was only when we were in the 14 New York Whole Foods, but we did need to, I did want to change the formula.
Yeah.
I actually ended up liking the cashew even better. It was a little lighter.
Mm.
It didn't feel sort of as heavy.
Yeah.
It's the opposite of light.
Mm.
But I had no idea. I mean, we had to stop selling for 6 to 8 weeks in, you know, at Fresh Direct and at Whole Foods when we did the change. It was a nightmare getting rid of one SKU and getting the other one on. We had to put a sticker on the new one saying new formula, now with cashews.
Mm.
And we lost like 3 months of sales at the end of the day because it didn't pick up where the other one left off, which is what you think is going to happen. So I think that's the really good advice out there.
Like,
I don't know how to prevent it other than try to get it right the first time. I don't know.
Yeah,
we didn't
have the formula change, so we didn't have to put out any notices about it. But it's like starting all over again.
Right. Because you think people are just going to be like, oh, I'll just get that now instead of what I got last week. But they don't.
No, the buyers don't.
Yeah.
They don't make that switch. And then, and so everything kind of grinds to a halt.
Yep.
And then there you are just trying to resell your same product to all your accounts again. And then by having that hiccup, they've filled your space already.
Right.
So you don't even have the slots anymore.
Yeah.
So
do you feel like had you not done that, you would still have a big fresh presence? Because it's mostly in Costco fresh?
That's correct.
And
yes.
everywhere else Costco's you're doing all these other really
fresh,
cool, innovative things that we'll talk about. But the fresh sauce right now is only in Costco.
True. Yes. Yes.
And do you think you would have kept it in the other stores?
Yes.
Got it.
I think we would have.
Right.
So
okay, that's helpful because I was like, maybe it's just such a nightmare of a business that they decided to get out of it.
No, I mean, I will say it. You know, you have to evaluate like when you have a lot of different kinds of product lines,
right.
like the fresh, the chips, the shelf stable sauce.
Right.
Now, you know, you're selling to three different
buyers. Yep.
So it's the logistics. It gets complicated, right?
Yes.
So
yeah, I know it's interesting because one of the questions that potential investors would always ask me is like, where else, you know, what other categories do you see? And I'm like, first of all, I think there's a lot of runway in this category. Like,
yes.
I think we're good for a couple of years,
but
I would just be like, well, you know, so potential investors that are listening to this, I kind of BS'd, but I didn't really, because I do think that there are other categories where a cooking school can help people.
Yeah.
But what people don't realize is that it's not as if you're doing really well in one place in the store and all of the buyers are just like, sure, come on down.
Mm-hmm.
You have to sell into those guys just as much. Like
exactly.
You might be doing well in, you know, in chips, but just because then you launch a yogurt doesn't necessarily right. mean the dairy buyer is going to be into it.
No, it doesn't at right. all. And so it just complicates your business a lot.
So can we talk a little bit about the change? I mean, as we said, there was no Amazon. Mm-hmm. There was no Instagram. There was no direct-to-consumer. Mm-hmm. Now you have sort of like you're a legacy company that's got like a very strong consumer base and a reputation that is like perfect in 16 years. But you also have to deal with the fact that there are all these things just coming at you from 85 different directions. How do you think about that? How's the landscape changed for you in a good way? Like, how has it helped you? How do you feel you wish you would have gotten on something earlier? Are you like, what are your thoughts around all that?
Yeah, I think we've made our peace with the fact that our best selling line, our sauces, are never going to be something that works on Amazon. Glass jars. Right. Let's just not even worry about that.
Right.
You know, but it has Amazon has informed our innovation. Right.
So how?
We think about we're doing now pouches with dolls,
right, yes.
so they're not glass, right? Mm-hmm. So we think about, okay, you know, it's not that we would never launch another thing in glass. I'm not, you know, it's not like I'm only going to think about Amazon
right.
when I'm thinking about innovation. But it is, it's in our minds.
Absolutely.
Like, could this work on Amazon or not?
Right.
So that is a factor that it wasn't for us in the beginning. But I do see a lot of new brands, a lot of Indian brands have sprung up in the time since we started our business. That I actually think it's great.
Yeah, because I mean, in one way, you know, who's I asking a similar question to? You know, the idea that they're, you know, the category's growing, people are exposed to Indian food, to Southern Indian food in particular, that more people know what tikka masala is.
Yep.
That's going to be good for you because you are sort of the top in that category.
Mm-hmm.
It means that you have to shift your strategy a little bit because you're not necessarily the only person responsible for educating everybody on what it
right.
is. But now you have to compete in a couple of other different
ways. People have
other choices. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, India is a big country.
Yeah.
The U.S. is a big country.
Lots of
There's
brands.
Plenty
lots
of room for lots of us to coexist.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I mean, to me, it's like I do love seeing the category grow. And, and I like seeing, you know, slowly but surely more space being allotted to, you know, quote
global.
Unquote, ethnic foods.
Right, right.
Global. I like that much better.
I know. Yeah. It's troublesome. There's just a lot of weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then thinking about innovation, other than sort of what's going to work for e-commerce and what's going to be lighter weight and what's not going to break, how do you think about innovation? And how did these new products kind of come about? And was there a sort of formal process behind it? Were you trying to solve for something? Were you just like, you know, we should make rice? Like,
so many things come into play. I mean, it's in this age of data, right? That's yet another. It's like, well, what sells a lot?
Right.
But if that's the only thing that's driving a business, then you've lost your soul.
Yeah.
But I learned a really good way of thinking about food from my time at Savour and working with those really amazing founding editors who just always focused on how, you know, if we're going to put food in this magazine, you know, it's got to come from someplace real. It has to, we're not making things up. We're not reinventing cheesecake. You know, like we are going to Oaxaca and, you know, we're going to the Philippines or we're going to find out what people are making in their kitchens that their mothers and grandmothers made. And so for me, I think about that. I think it's got to start from something real that Indians love to eat.
Yeah, that's great.
And so that's my beginning place. And then I like to think about how I can work with that and riff on it a little bit, just enough to maybe catch people's eye. Like, okay, it's got, you know, it's got kale in it, or it's right. got some another vegetable, like a carrot in the dal that yep. you wouldn't have thought would be in there, butternut squash or something. Yeah. You know, like think about vegetables when right. you're thinking about dals, and put those two things together in a way that maybe an Indian person wouldn't, but to me it still feels like it's honoring the whole tradition.
And does it go through the, like, what's it going to do to the business? How is it going to affect the business yeah. kind of system? So does it start mm-hmm. with, like, let's start with something real that yes. is that, like, feels authentic to the way that people eat and the way I want to sort of represent Southern Indian cuisine. Mm-hmm. And then it goes through a process with all right. the finance people
the ops people. So it's kind of everybody, marketing too, because what mm-hmm. we do is we like size the opportunity. Okay. Right.
If yeah, this tell
is
me about what, that.
So we say we want to do dolls. Okay. We need to go get the data on the category.
Right.
Now, this gets a little tricky with Indian food because it's not very well categorized
right.
in the systems that are available in SPINS and stuff. So you have to yep. do a bunch of digging and, you know brand names, so you have to find them and pull them out and, you know, make your own kind of aggregate. So,
but this is something I want to just pause for a second, because this is something that I did not think about at all. I had no idea what category meant. I would not have known what you were talking about like 18 months ago. But I think it's something that at this point, when people ask me for advice, the first thing I say, I think we talked about it even before the show, mm-hmm. you're in a category.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think of ourselves as in a category because there isn't a fresh sauce category, but right. there is a sauce category, and there's like sauce add meat. Like,
right.
The way sauce is categorized is really weird and funny. But you have to slice it somehow, and mm-hmm. it's on you, just like I kind of say to founders, like it's on you to know how to read a cash flow, like
yes.
and understand the finance. It's also on you to know what your actual potential market is for your product and mm-hmm. what your category looks like and who else is in it. And, you know, something like when I had Raquel on from Ghee, you know, mm-hmm. from Fourth and Heart,
yeah,
you know, if she had started a ghee company and was like, it's a $18 billion, you know, it's not. Yeah, it's not. It's like 6 million or something. It's little. I don't remember exactly what the market size is. But it's not a big market. And you as a founder can't assume that you are going to bring the world
right.
to ghee, right. Yes. right?
Yeah. You have to know what's come before.
Right.
And it gives you some guideposts about, like, what is this, a big space
right.
or is it small? And if it's small, how big could it be?
Right.
And what are the
who
trends?
Could I bring to it? And mm-hmm. how will I get them there?
Yep. Yep. How fast is it growing? And, yep. and look at the last couple of years and the last 12 weeks and the last 52. Yeah. So you just have to know how to, you know, use the information that's out there to inform what you prioritize.
Have you had any babies, not children, but like product babies that just, they're like, no, Maya, no, we're not doing this one.
Yes.
Okay.
But I'm still hopeful. I'm not even going to say it out loud because I'm still pushing for it.
And have you had any that sort of marketing has come to you and been like, this would be great? And you're like, no.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely. You know, and again, I don't want to say it out loud because I'll probably end up launching
right.
it one day. But
that's very funny.
But yes, it's a push and pull, right? It's like,
yeah.
what's trendy right, right now? And are we, you know, I will just say like the whole keto thing. It's
yeah.
like, okay, I just can't bring myself to build my business around that. Around that. If it happens to fit with what
right.
we're doing, then
yes.
I'm good. But I can't contort
myself. I like to call it fad agnostic.
Yeah.
How about that?
I like that.
Because, you know, and I mean, you've seen so much. You've seen them come and go. You've seen high carb come and go.
Exactly.
You've seen high fat come and go. Call it Atkins, call it keto, call it whatever.
Right. Yep.
I don't know. So I have thoughts on that, which I will not share right now. So do you feel like you did anything to sort of educate consumers on these new flavor profiles, even when you were kind of at the various stages of the business?
Yeah.
How did you get the word out about what Indian food should taste like? How did you tell people what these things were?
Oh, I mean, I'm sure that I could have done much more, but what I did was I just used the packaging. I mean, I just wrote a little story about right. each and every, you know, sauce and a little, just even though it's not, it's like a small little paragraph, I just always tried to get in there what, you know, what are the key spices you're going to taste in right. here? What's the part of India that it comes from?
Right.
You know, what are you going to feel when you eat it? Like
yeah.
just... Because, yeah, that's all you have to go by. You know, that's
right.
all people really get is like a couple sentences. So I think, you know, we were probably preaching to the choir for a
right.
long time there, where it's people who already knew they liked Indian food. And
right.
then you just, you hope that they migrate with you to the next flavor and the next
right.
flavor. And I think that is what's happened. And I think that there's been... Indian, the rise in interest mm-hmm. in Indian food goes along with the rise in interest in a lot of other cuisines too.
Yeah.
So it's an opening up of our minds. And then as we get more specific about what we do and don't eat, you know, then you have to kind of look around and see what's available in
right.
the world that fits with what your preferences are.
Do you feel like you've shifted, like, do you feel kind of with the rise of Instagram and social media that you've shifted? I mean, it seems to
yeah.
me like you have made, I feel like it's pretty obvious that there's a deliberate move.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking at Catherine. to be very
yes.
current and to be with the younger brands and, you
yeah,
know, on social
sure.
and
yep,
talking
yep,
directly
I think,
and all of that stuff.
Yep. I mean, I love Instagram. I love it personally. I
right.
just think, you know, I think it's a great tool for just that ability to convey what you're doing just in a split second. So, yes,
right.
that's a platform that we're using to try to get people to understand what exactly is inside our foods,
right.
what it, you know, break it down, what are the ingredients.
And you're in 7,000-ish stores right now,
yeah.
and you're still growing and still
We are,
trying.
Knock on
yeah,
wood.
It's
yeah.
amazing. Okay, so we are running out of time, and I don't want to get the, like, glare from Matt, but I do have a big question, I think, is if you were just advising me, you know,
yeah,
and the founders and the people that are listening, what... do you wish you had known earlier on? What would you say is sort of like, this is an important thing for you to know? What are some things that you would like us to avoid,
yeah.
if possible?
Yeah.
Some real
well,
good advice.
Excuse me. I think an early piece of advice that we got that I'm really grateful we got was not to over innovate. When you're
uh-huh.
starting,
yep.
don't think that you just have to come out
Keep
with a new
out,
product
right.
every year just because you're going to Expo or just because you don't want to stand in front of the buyers and say, oh, well, no, actually, I don't have anything new this year.
Right.
It's fine.
Yeah.
You know, don't let that pressure drive you, because you need to take what you've got and really prove it out and
yep.
build some great stories around it and be able to take those stories to more and more retailers around the country. Because there are so many.
Mm-hmm.
And so proving that
that's a great piece of
success,
advice.
You know, with a few products, I think.
I pushed my team.
I did. Yeah.
We were going to have 2 new SKUs in 2020. And my head of ops came to me and she was like, maybe we should just stick with the 5 we have. And I was like,
yeah.
all right, let's compromise. So we're coming out with 1.
Okay.
Which I'm very excited about. And I think it rounds out our little rainbow very nicely.
Yeah.
But definitely from an ops perspective, she was like, this is, you
mm-hmm.
know, it's a lot.
Yeah.
And on a small team.
Right.
To have, you know, I mean, and we did a seasonal cranberry
oh,
last
seasonal
year that I was super like cranberry, you know, and it was a nightmare. I mean, we lost a lot of money. It was delicious. It was great,
I'm
but
sure.
we had product left over. We
yeah.
like no one could
I'm
take it because we did it. You sh- it's just
outs.
It's
yeah.
not a good call. Seasonal
yeah.
SKUs. I don't know. And John Lawson, who was on here, was like, why would you make cranberry sauce? Why wouldn't you try telling people how to use chimichurri on Thanksgiving? Yeah. Like, why would you do that? I'm like, that was a good call. I wish I hadn't done that.
Yeah.
Okay, so don't over-innovate. Anything else?
I mean, I think what's going to happen if your business is sort of, you know, doing fairly well is you're going to get approached by a lot of investors. Yeah. And so you need to have a point of view on that. And I didn't have a particular point of view. I was just like, you know, mildly flattered and just sort of, no, I don't think so. But it's important to understand what that can do for your business.
Right. So because you did ultimately take investment.
We did.
But recently.
Yeah, just in February.
Which is amazing. So, you had like 15 years in business, and that was the first time you took outside investment.
Yeah, we had done a little bit of angel, like a small, very small angel round. But yes, basically that was the first investment you took. So, and that someone else had given me that advice that wait as long as you can before you sell part of your company. But I think just have those conversations with people who approach you. Just start to educate yourself about what investment means and talk to other people who took investment and figure out.
And what was the ultimate decision for you? Like, why the ultimate decision?
Well, I had conversations with people over the years, so I had built up a comfort level with this one particular firm, and so I liked them a lot, and I mean, our business, we've hit bumps, right? Mm-hmm. And so we were, it was a point where, you know, we actually do need the money.
Right.
Now. There's a lot of competition out there. We need to stay ahead of that. We need to build our distribution out, and we need marketing to really help pull that product off the shelf, because we can get it on the shelf, but how are we getting it off?
What we talk about on this podcast all the time. I think it's harder and harder for food businesses not to take outside money.
Yeah.
And I think too. Especially the food-driven founders, the people that start it not from like I'm in business school and I'm looking at a white space, but someone who really just loves the food and wants to create something that doesn't exist. We don't tend to be in the position where, you know, we can just kind of like run it for a few years, see what happens, not have any income, not be able, you know, I mean, it's just, it's expensive to do. And you do, I think because everything is omnichannel now, and I think because the barriers to getting into the food industry are so low now, you know, you can make a great package and like put something in it that's basically resold from something else and make $1 million on Instagram. You can.
I know.
You know? And so there's just so much noise that to get out ahead of it, I don't know. I have friends that have done both. I think it's challenging, especially unlike you, if you don't have margins that help you get profitable really soon. So this is one of the reasons why on this show also we always talk about like, get your margins as nice as possible. Save as much money on making the product as you can, because you'll get to profitability sooner and you won't need that money. So you'll be, if you do want to raise money, you'll be in a position of strength.
Exactly. And that I would also add to that, you know, it's when you do come to this business as from a place of passion, you know, you're sort of focused on how you can make something really delicious. You're not thinking about
how much it's going to cost.
How much it's going to cost. And you have to get, to your point, smart about that very quickly. Like, you've got to, you can still have delicious as your goal, but it's got to, you might be making some compromises along the way.
Yep. Because that's what life is.
Yes.
On that note. all right. Anything, best moment, a moment where you were like, this, I love my job.
Best moment.
I mean, I'm sure you've had many.
I have had many really great moments. I mean, I do still have that, I mentioned it earlier, but that picture, that image in my mind of that woman walking around Fairway with the clipping of my sauce, like, where is it? I need to find this.
Yeah. the best feeling in the world.
It is. Yeah. I mean, there have been so many. I love what I do. I mean, I really do. So it's like, it's a series of great moments.
Yeah. I'm just that's so happy. Nice. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's thank just you. A pleasure meeting you and getting to talk to you, and hopefully we'll stay in touch.
Yes,
and thanks. I'll be able to call you and ask you all sorts of harassing questions.
Anytime.
For all of you listening, thank you for listening, and I'll be back next week with another episode of In the Sauce. Oh, Matt, thanks for being the best engineer ever. See you next week. In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.